hello and welcome to Polity Matters. My name is Ben Ratliff. I'm joined, as always, by Jared Nelson and Scott Edberg. And today we are jumping into BCO Chapter 13 on the Presbytery. As you, dear listeners, know, we began a few weeks ago in Book of Church Order Chapter 10, addressing church courts. We moved to their jurisdiction. We've dealt with the session. And as we move along, we're aiming at Chapter 14 on the General Assembly, all in anticipation of that 51st General Assembly that's coming up in Richmond, Virginia later this year. And so today we're taking a look at the middle court of our church, the Presbytery. So the session, with its ruling elders and teaching elders, oversees the work of the local church. But then in the Presbytery, teaching elders and churches come together to oversee matters ranging from church planning to teaching elder ordination, from judicial matters to sending up overtures to the assembly year by year. And so we're going to get into the exciting work of this church courts. Guys, check in with us. How are y'all doing? What's exciting to you about talking about the Presbytery chapter? I know that you've been eager for it, I'm sure.
I'm excited to talk about Hodge and Thornwell, so you'll just have to wait until we get there, though.
Oh, boy.
I like the Presbytery and the idea that we don't always talk about it, its work on a regular basis to our congregation. And so for those who are listening, they get the opportunity perhaps to get a better window. You sometimes see things on the internet, and that's not always accurate or helpful. And so I'm glad to talk about that process.
Things on the internet that are not accurate or helpful. That's a good line. Let's jump into Presbytery. Chapter 13, paragraph 1 begins this way. The Presbytery consists of all the teaching elders and churches within its bounds that have been accepted by the Presbytery. When the Presbytery meets as a court, it shall comprise all teaching elders and ruling elders as elected by their session. Each congregation is entitled to two ruling elder representatives for the first 350 communing members or fraction thereof, and one additional ruling elder for each additional 500 communing members or fraction thereof. So this paragraph deals with the members of the Presbytery, just in general, and then also when it meets. And just for some clarity, I think I read it a little quick there. It is all teaching elders, stop, and then ruling elders as elected by their session up to a certain number, depending on your congregation's size. So what's significant here, guys, sort of starting with the basics, but that can be very helpful for many of our listeners, I'm sure.
Yeah, so here the membership of the Presbytery, it's defined, and it's defined by both the teaching elders and the churches represented particularly. The ruling elders do not maintain their membership within the local Presbytery, and therefore they are not innately members of it, but their churches are, and their churches elect individuals from their local sessions to participate at the Presbytery level as their own representatives. And so in practicality, it's teaching and ruling elders make up the Presbytery, but it's the ruling elders as representing the churches that they're called by. And so they're representatives, not innately members of the court. And what that means is that the ruling elders will rotate who goes and who it will be a member of that court for that particular meeting. And so there's a rotation. The teaching elders do not rotate. They remain members of the court, but the ruling elder, the makeup of the ruling elders will change as the year goes on.
Another interesting thing about this is the change over time in the Presbyterian Church. In the PCUSA before, you could have one ruling elder representative from your church. And you can see an increased emphasis on ruling elders here in the PCA, in that each church gets two. And in fact, if you're larger than that, you can get more than two. Another interesting element of this is the ruling elder is, in a sense, the representative of the church. And so if there's something happening with your church, you definitely want to have your rep there. In fact, every presbytery, you want to have at least one of your ruling elders there, because if something happens with your church, that's the person to say, hey, hold up, no, our minutes are right here. Or this thing that you want our church to do, like, this is how we want to do it. If he's not there, that your church doesn't have a voice in the same way through your teaching elder. Like, your teaching elder can't just rep your church. He's a member of Presbytery. So we've had problems with that before, of something happening with the church. The teaching elder's there, but no ruling elders. And we'll have to delay those things or just say, hey, your church can't actually complain about this because you didn't send a rep.
What about Elder Emeritus? I can't recall from our chapter on the elder. Are they allowed to be elected as representatives to the Presbytery?
I would say yes. They can, because in my mind, it is the same as a man who rotates off of a session in a rotating system. And I believe that a man who might be inactive is still an ordained elder, and it is up to the discretion of the session to nominate and send that man forward. And so I would think that they could.
Oh, you know what? We actually haven't gotten to this in our study of the book yet. Anyway, it's not in the chapter on elder. It's in chapter 24, talking about deacons and elders by reason of age or infirmity being released from the duties of office. They're no longer required to perform regular duties, but they may continue to perform certain duties on a voluntary basis if requested by the session or a higher court. So that seems to agree with what Scott just said. So
I don't
congratulations.
know. Jared had a smirk on his face. I was wondering where he was going with that.
Is he smiling at the fact that we're both wrong? Is that what's happening? Or
I'm just enjoying the random speculation. I guess so.
this is one of those places I think it's kind of funny that a church of 350 can send two ruling elders to Presbytery, but if you have one more member, you can send three ruling elders to Presbytery. It's one of those lines that's funny to walk around. Any other thoughts here before we get going? This is kind of just setting the base for us. 13:2. Getting into the matters of a teaching elder and his membership in the presbytery, a minister shall be required to hold his membership in the presbytery within whose geographical bounds he resides, unless there are reasons which are satisfactory to his presbytery why he should not do so. When a minister labors outside the geographical bounds of, or in a work not under the jurisdiction of his presbytery, at home or abroad, it shall be only with the full concurrence of and under circumstances agreeable to his presbytery and to the presbytery within whose geographical bounds he labors, if one exists. When a minister shall continue on the rolls of his presbytery without a call to a particular work for a prolonged period, not exceeding 3 years, the procedure as set forth in BCO 3410 shall be followed. A minister without call shall make or file a report to his presbytery at least once a year. And there's an editorial comment here just for our own understanding. The provision for a minister to hold his membership in the presbytery within whose geographical bounds he resides does not apply to the non-geographical Korean language presbyteries as long as the General Assembly mandates their existence. Well, there's a lot going on here. We should probably talk first about presbytery geographical boundaries. Maybe this is a good time to have that conversation about how presbyteries are set up geographically and the significance of those boundaries. And then we can talk about membership of this TE and jurisdictional boundaries as well. So either one of y'all want to wax eloquently about geographical boundaries, it's such an intriguing topic.
Well, sometimes the boundaries are really easy. It's the state. So you can have an entire state, or I think with some of the New England ones, it's maybe three states at once or something like that. Otherwise, it may get down to it's these counties or this half of a county to this river, and those will be spelled out what that geographical bound is. And sometimes it gets interesting. I'm in a county that's right up next to another presbytery. And so some of the closest BCA churches to me are in another presbytery. And so you can imagine there may be a pastor who lives in my county and then goes right across the border to the PCA church that he's in. So it may just be for reasons of the fact that this is where houses were available or something like that. But it has to be agreeable to the presbytery he's in. If he's a member of my presbytery and then is laboring in another presbytery or something like that, you have to get permission for that.
Yeah, there's lots of guidelines that have been set up across the years from the General Assembly on how to establish presbyteries and their recommended sizes and things. Just a couple of examples. Back in 1974, when all this was sort of being hammered out for the first time, it's recommended that presbyteries be limited generally to a diameter of 150 miles in order to maintain elder participation. That's generally true. I'd say there's some out west, right? I know our presbytery is a little bit bigger than that, but further out west, they're larger and larger as fewer and fewer churches in certain areas. It says their number shall generally be limited to 40 churches. And later on, there's a recommendation somewhere that when a presbytery approaches 30 churches total, they should really consider if they'd be better off splitting and continuing to grow on their own. So while none of this is mandated in terms of size, there's some recommendations here. How many churches are in y'all's presbyteries, out of curiosity? We've got about 50 or 52.
We have 12.
16.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, we probably should have considered splitting a long time ago. It's a conversation that keeps coming up. We just have never pulled the trigger.
Well, the question may be asked, when does this actually happen? I think this actually happens quite a bit if you have somebody that is a college professor or a seminary professor that is living in one presbytery but is working in another one. Perhaps they even have two calls. Maybe they're pastoring one place and teaching in another. And so those are instances in which you may have permission given to say, hey, I know Brian, our stated clerk, Brian Chappell, was a member of Illiana over in Illinois while he was seminary professor or seminary president of Covenant Theological Seminary, which was in Missouri's jurisdiction. But he had always lived there. He had pastored a church that was there, so decided to give permission for him to be laboring in Missouri Presbytery, but was a member of Illiana.
That's good.
And he remains a member of North Illinois Presbytery, which was his previous call before the stated clerk's office.
You might see some, even though there's provisions for it, you might see many, honorably retired men move to a different geographical area, but retain their membership in their previous presbytery. When I served in Grace Presbytery, we used to get letters at every single stated meeting from Dale Ralph Davis, who was still a member of Grace Presbytery but lived outside our bounds, and he would give some elaborate humorous reason that he couldn't be present, which is simply just that he didn't live there. But it was usually more flowery than that. Also, you might think about, I've seen it happen with church planters before, where one presbytery might call a guy to plant churches kind of on the outskirts of the presbytery that might even start to overlap on the border between them and another. And so you might go in and join up with another presbytery and kind of have an arrangement of where his membership is, but where he's permitted to work, depending on how the geographical lines are drawn. So, what about this idea of laboring outside of geographical bounds or not under the jurisdiction? This is really two distinguishing marks here, that bounds for a presbytery are on the one hand geographical, which we've addressed, but also are jurisdictional. So you might have a man working, as we often say, out of bounds. He's a member of the presbytery, but he's working for, say, RTS in Jackson, Mississippi. He's working for an institution that's not under the jurisdictional bounds of the presbytery. He's working out of bounds, not necessarily geographically, but in terms of his work and who's responsible for overseeing him in his work. And of course, our book here says that it has to be under circumstances that are agreeable to his presbytery. What other circumstances might fall into this train of thought, or there's all sorts of numbers of combinations I'm sure we could come up with.
Well, we got to remember that they're out of bounds is actually two different separate ideas
Right.
within BCO chapter 8 and 8-4. It's dealing with geographical issues. That's the Brian Chappell example we just offered, or a seminary professor who might have his credentials out of Ascension but serve at Westminster, Philadelphia or something. Then there is outside of the jurisdiction of the PCA itself, and this would be BCO 8-7. And so this would be any ministry that the PCA as an institution has no authority over. You could think of parachurch ministries, or say a pastor serves as pulpit supply at a non-PCA church, but he's only doing it in the interim until they find a pastor, those kind of scenarios where they're outside of the jurisdiction of the PCA, but the PCA still holds that man's credentials. And so we've kind of given them most of them. Coordinators could fall in this category. A coordinator doesn't necessarily have to be in the geographical bounds. A coordinator of one of our agencies, MNA, MTW, and likewise. What I find interesting in this passage of the BCO is that it's not only that the presbytery that he is credentialed to prove his call, but that the presbytery within which his jurisdiction will serve must also approve his call. And so you can't have a guy that moves onto the field of another presbytery's quote unquote territory without that presbytery's approval. And that seems to make sense. There might be, if you're doing perhaps, I don't know, just think of like an ESL ministry in your presbytery in Huntsville. And Evangel says, hey, we're going to do an ESL ministry in Huntsville and we're commissioning a guy. You'd step on each other's feet over that issue. And so you want to make sure that all your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed when you're seeking to move outside the bounds of your own local jurisdiction.
This came up in the past with a professor who wanted to teach at a seminary that one presbytery thought was a needful work, but the presbytery in which it was in said it was not. So if you want to go look up the Peter Lightheart thing with Evangel Presbytery, it was a seminary that was feeding non-NAEPARC churches, and so that presbytery said, no, this is not a legitimate work that he's being called to there. So the presbyteries didn't agree. So either he would not move on to the field, or he would move on to the field and would not be credentialed for that work.
And a former moderator falls into that category as well with George Robertson. He actually was a son of First Pres Tuscumbia, and so they were fond of him in my previous call. But he sought to take a EPC church in Memphis, and I don't believe his credentials were ultimately transferred. He joined the EPC instead.
In that case, actually, it was Covenant Presbytery was willing to accept him, but it was his originating presbytery that wasn't willing to transfer him. They wouldn't transfer him to Covenant Presbytery. They would only transfer him to his EPC Presbytery. It was a very interesting situation.
The final provision there we probably should talk about too, which is
Keep going.
a teaching elder without call, and this would be somebody, it's assumed here, that is not retiring, but is somebody that perhaps resigned and didn't have another call they're going to or something like that, and they're not to exceed 3 years. So you can't have just go without call, keep your credentials, and you're pastoring, but you don't have any flock. After a while, you have to make a provision for that. And there it says those ministers that are without call have to give a report of, are you looking? What are you doing right now? You doing some pulpit supply? What's going on? At least once a year. Note that it's pastors without call. This isn't every single teaching elder in the presbytery has to give a report, because you actually have some oversight with your session. They know what you're doing. Whereas somebody without call, they want to know what they're doing.
I find this provision helpful in that it doesn't make it personal when you're dealing with this issue. It could be a very emotionally charged thing to remove someone or for have to have someone demit office because they don't have a call. And so to have some parameters for like, hey, this is just what we have to do. This is what our constitution says. You've been without call for 3 years, no ministry. And so we have to pursue this because our constitution tells us to.
And moving into 3410 doesn't require them to depose him or take away his credentials. It just means they have to look into it. I've seen it happen in a couple different presbyteries that you don't wind up seeing a man who's without call sometimes at presbytery meetings because he's often taken a vocational job of some kind in the world, and so he's not able to come to presbytery as he normally was able to when he had a call from a church. And so that this sort of forced pastoral oversight is wise and good. There's a lot crammed into some of these paragraphs. They're a little full. What about this editorial comment? I forget the years. Y'all might know better than I will. Was it 1996 that we finished and established the Korean language presbyteries for sure? So it's been almost 30 years since they've been in existence. And they're non-geographical presbyteries. Either one of y'all care to comment on what that means?
Well, they overlap with other presbyteries. So they are a geographical area, but it just covers Korean language areas that overlap with others. So, we've dealt with that before when we try to think of, hey, what are the presbyteries that are in Pennsylvania? Well, you think of the ones that are drawn on the map, but then you also have to think there's also a Korean language presbytery that overlaps in our state. And so you might have a church that's right next door in the geographical bounds of another presbytery, but if they're Korean language, then they're not going to be in your presbytery and they're exempt from those things.
What are the requirements for changing an editorial comment in the BCO? Is it the same as actually amending the BCO? Because it actually calls them non-geographical Korean language presbyteries, which is, and I think you're correct, Jared. They actually are geographical. They just are on a different plane of geography, I suppose, than the other ones. Anyway,
Different dimension.
what an editorial comment. I've never really thought about that.
I mean, I think it's fine. When you think of affinity, I disagree with you guys. That's what I'm getting at. I think they're non-geographical in that there's only one geography. That would be like saying, well, we have affinity presbyteries. They're geographical in that like there are two presbyteries in the state of Alabama, but they're based on affinity rather than, the location. So I don't know. I think it's a correct editorial comment, and I think you're just wrong.
Moving on to BCO 13.3. All these hot takes today. Every ruling elder not known to the presbytery shall produce a certificate of his regular appointment from the session of the church which he represents. I have never seen this happen before. So curious.
Well, this is probably just the ruling elder's first time at presbytery,
right?
And he's representing the church for the first time. He just needs to bring a letter with him that says you actually are the delegate of this church. At least it seems to be what Morton Smith thinks this provision is about.
I think our presbytery just takes our word for it usually. We're like, hey, this guy's with us. They're like, all right, that's fine.
We send an email to the clerk that lets him know who our ruling elder delegates will be.
So official. It is important to designate your ruling elders to presbytery. That can be an exception of substance, I suppose, on a session records. Anything else? 13.3 so full of valuable information. 13.4, let's talk about quorums and some telecommunication things. Any three ministers belonging to the presbytery, together with at least three ruling elders, being met at the time and place appointed, which may include a teleconference or video conference place, shall be a quorum competent to proceed to business. However, any presbytery, by a majority vote of those present at a stated meeting, may fix its own quorum, provided it is not smaller than the quorum stated in this paragraph. The presbytery, in its discretion, may for itself and its subordinate committees, commissions, adopt rules determining when video conference or telecommunication arrangements may be used for meetings and regulating how meetings using telecommunications arrangements shall be conducted. So some of this is more recent. Some of this is similar principles that we saw with the session being applied at the presbytery level, dealing with quorum. The first thing we see is that in order for a presbytery to conduct business, there must be a parity of elders present, three ruling elders and three teaching elders at the right time and place. If not, I think it was Morton Smith I found that said this. He said, if not, the only action that they can take when they've assembled is to situate another meeting in the future. So if the moderator's there, he can establish the next meeting so that they can try again. But if they happen to take some action, that action is necessarily needs to be approved by the next stated meeting of that presbytery in order to validate and sort of stamp what they've done. Otherwise, it would be an invalid action.
Yeah, you can make a huge mess if you don't have a quorum.
Oh, man.
Making sure you at least have three ruling elders there. There has been presbyteries in the past that have done this, and then you start to ask questions about, wait, if you did an ordination during that, or if you appointed delegates to General Assembly, those really aren't actions that have been taken by the presbytery. They have to be ratified by the next presbytery meeting for them to be valid. So don't do that. If you don't have a quorum, you just have to dismiss and figure out when you're going to meet again.
We're going to learn about it a little bit later on in the chapter about how you can call a presbytery meeting. It's interesting to me that you have to call a presbytery meeting when requested to do so by three ruling elders and three teaching elders representing at least three different churches. I suppose it's the elders representing three different churches, the ruling elders. But here it's not. So you could have, I mean, in our presbytery, in theory, you could have three teaching elders and three ruling elders show up from the same church, and they could be a quorum of our presbytery and take action as the whole body. Whereas even just calling a meeting is a little more stringent than that, even. Just interesting little things where I don't know, is this a place to tighten up? Seems a little, maybe for y'all's presbyteries. Ours is huge. This is probably reasonable for y'all.
I would assume your presbytery has standing rules that further tighten that.
I actually went and looked it up. We do not tighten on our quorum requirement. We maintain the 3 and 3. So... surprising to me. Maybe we need to tighten up.
Yeah, I'd be against tightening up the BCO, but we probably should have presbyteries tighten it up.
Well, it used to be a lot looser. This comes out of debate between northern and southern approaches. Charles dun, dun, Hodge dun. Didn't think you. There you go. Sorry. Charles Hodge didn't think that you needed any ruling elders to be present. They weren't the real members of presbytery, and so. This was changed when the Southern Church redid their BCO after they became separate entities to three teaching elders and one ruling elder. And it wasn't until the PCA got a hold of this that it finally was made three teaching elders and three ruling elders. So that parity that Thornwell was on the other side of that. He wanted a parity there. Didn't get it until about 100 years later when the PCA made their Book of Church Order.
What we should know when we're thinking about a quorum is that if there is no quorum, there is no court. And as Jared referenced before with the Presbytery minutes, you can have ruling elders and teaching elders that gather together, but if there is no quorum, there is no court meeting. And whatever you do in that meeting is not a meeting of the court itself. It is just a group of guys getting together to talk. And so there is a distinction between meeting together, but also having the presbytery meet in a formalized manner. And you have to hit that threshold. So a quorum is, I think, valuable in maintaining the plurality of elders within the church, whether that be locally at your session or at the presbytery level, because it is by that quorum that you can do business in a plural manner. It's not just Scott Edberg or us three getting together and defining the work of the church.
So we're three teaching elders. We can't just become a presbytery here.
No. It could be an affinity presbytery. That's also geographical.
I was transferred into Covenant Presbytery over a teleconference meeting of our presbytery. It's the only one we've ever had. It was a very reasonable and simple transfer exam. There were two of us that
So
came in.
are you a real pastor or a virtual pastor?
I mean, I am v virtually a pastor. Let's keep going. We're going to talk about receiving teaching elders into the presbytery in 13:5. Ordinarily, only a minister who receives a call to a definite ecclesiastical work within the bounds of a particular presbytery may be received as a member of that presbytery, except in cases where the minister is already honorably retired, or in those cases deemed necessary by the presbytery, subject to the review of the General Assembly. In such cases deemed necessary, which may include the case of a minister without call, whose circumstances appear to require relocation within the bounds of that presbytery, a time allotment of BCO 13:2 shall be counted from the day the minister was first continued on the roll without call in any presbytery. So, Scott, this whole paragraph begins with one of your favorite words in the BCO, ordinarily. Does
Yeah.
that mean that we don't have to follow any of this?
Ordinarily is the best word in the English language because it is a mere recommendation. I ordinarily wake up and brush my teeth, but sometimes I forget. And so, though it is a normative practice
Wait, wait,
for
wait, wait, wait. No, 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 no. Sometimes you forget to brush your teeth.
I
You
sometimes, you
just
know, sometimes I may choose to have coffee first. I don't know, you know, kids. Kid, you
Ah,
know, that's the
yes.
answer. Kids
Gotcha. Yeah.
make the word ordinarily valuable.
Yep.
That's what we're learning here.
No need to say any more. Yeah.
So yeah, what this provision is trying to set out is saying this is the typical way by which you would deal with a man coming into your presbytery. And it's not the exclusive way. There is latitude for how to engage particular cases as outlined in that passage itself, one being a retired member and one being a member without call who may have been forced to relocate because of the lack of a call.
Yeah, the ordinarily is limited by the except there.
Right.
So,
Yeah. We've got guys like this in our presbytery. I can think of a couple of the honorably retired guys who retired from ministry serving in Grace Presbytery. And we have a gentleman that moved up from Grace and transferred his membership to our presbytery simply because he wanted to continue serving the church even in retirement. So he can still serve on committees and commissions. He was state of supply at one point for a little while. And so it allows them to continue to serve the church where they are. And maintain some fellowship among the men in the presbytery. And what's this language here at the end of the paragraph? What that that you don't start counting the 3 years again if you transfer to a new presbytery, basically, right? If you've been without a call for a year in your current presbytery, and you move to another presbytery, you've still been without call for a year, and you just keep counting up to three before 34:10 comes into play. Is that how y'all would read that?
You're breaking up a little.
What?
You work for me too.
Well, it'll record clear on my end. Well, listeners, let's just say that I
I'm
was right.
sure
So,
that.
You got to tell your kids to get off your Wi-Fi.
no kidding. I gotta...
Are they watching Bluey again?
I hope so. All right. Well, 30, nope, not 30. 13:6. 13:6. We're just cruising. It's a long chapter, but all pretty straightforward. Not a lot of commentary necessary in some of these cases. 13:6. Ministers seeking admission to a presbytery from other presbyteries in the Presbyterian Church in America shall be examined on Christian experience and also touching their views in theology, the sacraments, and church government. If applicants come from other denominations, the presbytery shall examine them thoroughly in knowledge and views as required by BCO 21:4 and require them to answer in the affirmative the questions put to candidates at their ordination. Ordained ministers from other denominations being considered by presbyteries for reception may come under the extraordinary provisions set forth in BCO 21:4. Presbyteries shall also require ordained ministers coming from other denominations to state the specific instances in which they may differ with the confession of faith and catechisms in any of their statements and or propositions, which differences the court shall judge in accordance with BCO 21:4. So you've got men that want to transfer in. They have to be examined by the presbytery. We call it typically referred to it as a views exam, Christian experience and views in theology, sacraments, and church government. Jared, have you ever taken a transfer exam? When you moved up to Ascension, did you were transferring your credentials? Yeah. So I think all of us have done this before. It's pretty straightforward for any teaching elders out there. It's not a scary exam.
Although it varies by presbytery.
Well, that's true.
Sometimes you have a written exam. It doesn't say what to do here, written or oral. My exam was committee and on the floor. I didn't have a written exam. It was all oral. So it was, and you see here, this is touching on views. This is mostly a views rather than a can you name this and all the things that are required under the main provision. So you actually do have a little bit of an advantage coming from another PCA presbytery into another one. It's not as if we're 88 different denominations.
When I was transferring into Ileana here, I finished my views in theology, and the chairman said, "Okay, now it's time to transition to Bible knowledge." And my eyes went wide because I was not ready to take a Bible knowledge exam without any prep or thought. Fortunately, I didn't, and they corrected course quickly. But they do change from presbytery to presbytery. I heard Potomac from a friend has a really extensive, like, 12-page written exam. It's not easy. And so Ileana wasn't too hard, just views.
We give a written exam for transfers, and the longest part of it is our Christian experience exam, which is long. It's the same one we give to everybody, licensed, ordained, or transfer. It's much longer than our views exam, which is usually just it's about 30 or 40 different points, but it's only, what about this? What about this? What about this? It's a lot of yes or no answers or things like that. So.
It should be noted on here, it's different if you're coming from another denomination, even if it's an APARC denomination. I had a friend that learned the hard way coming from the AARP. They just did basically a views exam and were cited on this. Like, no, you actually needed to do the full thing with him because he's coming from another denomination.
Now they could just do a regular views exam, but they'd have to what the extraordinary clause, right? Is it two-thirds, three-quarters approval to do an extraordinary case? To bring somebody in without the specifications of 21:4 in any of these cases. I have heard that before, Jared. Folks, even in the presbytery, will often say, well, he's coming from NAPARC. We don't have to do everything. Go, no, it doesn't specify anything except an other denomination.
And
Have
it's
you
at the
guys?
discretion
Yeah,
of the presbytery to
that's right.
determine how difficult that they would make those exams. You might be somewhat more lenient from an APARC denomination. It might not be as extensive. If you have a guy transferring in from the PCUSA or a non-NAPARC denomination, you might ask him questions concerning women's ordination or Calvinism or the authority and inspiration of Scripture. And so it's at the discretion of the presbytery how tough they want to make it for each individual, and it's a case by case. Or they could just do the normal procedure that they do with all their other candidates. That's probably most typical.
Have y'all seen the extraordinary clause used very often?
No.
Which is good, right? I mean, I went and pulled it 21:4H. The extraordinary clauses should be limited to extraordinary circumstances of the church or proven extraordinary gifts of the man. Presbyteries should exercise diligence and care in the use of these provisions in order that they not prevent the ordination of a candidate for whom they are truly exceptional circumstances, nor ordain a person who's inadequately prepared for the ministry. You know, sometimes you can get in situations where it can be presented as if it's an immediate rushed need, but the presbytery is encouraged to take due diligence to think through these things and not move ahead too quickly. Just another point where we're slow on purpose in many cases. It's a good thing for us to slow down and do things methodically.
Now, this is the section that there is an overture up for the 51st General Assembly to clarify some of this. What's coming from another denomination? What do you require from between presbyteries? So stay tuned for that.
I didn't know that. I'll make a note to put in the show notes the link to that overture. Is it already published or is it going to be coming up
it
soon?
It is. It's okay. Overture 2 from Northern California Presbytery.
I believe a teaching elder, Alex Ford, is the author of it. And the origin is whether you state a man's difference when he transfers into your presbytery. This section actually offers no guidance to that. I thought it was typical for you to do that, but there are presbyteries in the PCA that do not do that. And I think the amendment would also include a response for if you reject a transfer, that you have to give reasons to the presbytery that's trying to transfer why you've rejected them. And I think that's actually, I was reading this section within the larger Presbyterian world, that has been in other BCOs where you must give a reason for why you're rejecting this man's transfer to your presbytery. Why? Because it might be a reason of scandal. You might find out in that examination that he's done something terrible that should receive discipline for. And so I think generally the principle by North California is a good, I shouldn't share my hand that much, but it's a good principle generally.
I think you're allowed to do so if you choose. So they want to add that we have to record differences from transfers, basically.
And reasons from PCH. Why you would reject a
right.
guy.
Yeah. That seems wise. I mean, I've heard many stories, maybe not many, I've heard at least a handful of stories of guys, you know, in a committee meeting transferring their credentials and somebody just happens to ask, you know, have you ever been under church discipline or some kind of question that would reveal moral failure of some kind. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you're dealing with a guy who's got serious issues in his background that his previous presbytery didn't know about or never asked about. And now all of a sudden you have to deal with it. So it'd be a good thing to have provisions for. Those are always awkward conversations to have. Churches are usually eager to have their guys transferred smoothly. They don't like to see it held up.
Yeah.
We should have Alex on to talk about that overture. I have a lot of thoughts coming into my head. I think that makes us more Presbyterian. That would be a really good
Quality Matters
to talk
has
about.
No voting guide on Overture 2. Just personal opinions. Personal opinions.
Yeah, check with your attorneys before you apply any of the things that we're telling you to practice. Okay, 13.7. For a long time as a teaching elder, didn't realize this was a part of our BCO. I thought it was just something that certain presbyteries did. 13.7 reads, "The presbytery shall cause to be transcribed in some convenient part of the book of records the obligations required of ministers at their ordination, which shall be subscribed by all admitted to membership in the following form. I do sincerely receive and subscribe to the above obligation as a just and true exhibition of my faith and principles, and do resolve and promise to exercise my ministry in conformity thereunto." TEs that are ordained or admitted have to sign this statement and needs to go into the record of the presbytery. Is there any more than that? Why do we have something like this, guys? What's significant about that? Like, why would we have this in our presbyteries? Did I cut out again?
No.
Just the regular awkward silence.
Just the regular. I think Jared wants to answer this one.
That sounds about right.
I was trying to read through Morton Smith, and he doesn't seem really
for real.
Right.
Yeah. It is an interesting thing because not only are we taking our vows and answering affirmatively the questions of ordination in our installations and ordination services, but then we're also required to write this down here. I don't know of any provision like this for a ruling elder on his session before church. It seems kind of strange to me, I'll be honest. I know of one presbytery that makes you sign in your own blood, which is very weird That's a joke. Yeah. All right. Come on, guys.
I wouldn't be surprised.
That could be a beefy soundbite if somebody wanted to pull that. Yeah, it's sort of a doubling down, making sure that guys are committed and that we have a record of their commitment to what has been given to them to do.
Let me look at the history of that.
While Scott's looking around, this is a good time to remind y'all that PCAhistory.org is a great place to go and look at all sorts of fun things about the past of our denomination. And you can see the history of the BCO and its development over the many, many years and generations. Anything, Scott?
Thank you. Thank you, Wayne Sparkman.
Yes, that's right.
It just seems like a pullover from the Southern Church. Ramsey has comments on this being a part of the official transaction of a man into a presbytery. Ministers who refuses to subscribe as here required is not a member of the presbytery and should not come. I don't know if we've ever even thought thoroughly. I mean, I signed that document without, I think, reading it.
I will say I knew I think it was Grace Presbytery. We had to sign every year. They would have a ceremony, and quote unquote ceremony. You know, that would be a ruling elder would stand up and charge the teaching elders in the room, and then we would be required to sign our names again to the book of commitment. Which was a good encouragement every year and a reminder of what we were called to. I kind of liked that aspect of it.
It's kind of like you do in your church where you have the altar call and you have to go up at least once a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Presbyterian altar call. We sign our names in, with blood on ministerial subscription forms.
Only on Polity Matters, folks. Well, it's Future Ben here again, hoping that you've enjoyed the episode so far. Chapter 13 of the BCO is long enough. We thought it wise to split it in half, not to take up so much of your time this week. Be sure to come back next time when we conclude this discussion of presbyteries. If you're interested in learning more about anything we mentioned, check out the show notes in your podcast player or at politymatters.org. If you enjoyed the show, consider following us on Twitter and Facebook at Polity Matters, and be sure to subscribe in your podcast app of choice. If you've got questions or comments, you can contact us at politymattersfeedback@gmail.com. You can also find us all on Twitter. Just check the show notes for the proper links. We're so glad you decided to spend your time with us. Until next time, y'all take care.